Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Oui, Médis. Jeremy, I was thinking a little bit about this guest book thing in Wide Open, and a lot of people don't really sign their real name when they're at an open house. In the episode, they had like Elvis and Abraham Lincoln, Muhammad Ali, and Travis Bickle, Robert De Niro's character from Taxi Driver. So if you were signing a guest book, what name would you use?
Well, let's go with Rainer Muldrake, Mulder's fake name from X-Files. That might have been a little Easter egg for X-File fans.
Oh, that is perfect. I was thinking more along the lines of Queen Elizabeth. I was like somewhere totally different on that. Anyway, so welcome to The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast, Soylent Green is People. I'm your host, Paige Schechter, and with me today is Jeremy Daniels. Hi, Jeremy.
Hi, Paige. Nice to talk to you again.
You too. We last teamed up for Dead Letters, the third episode of the series, I believe. So I'm sure we'll talk a little bit about how the series is progressing at this point.
Yeah, for sure.
Today we're talking about episode 9 of the first season, Wide Open. It was the first episode to air in 1997, Happy New Year, and has a 7.4 rating at IMDb, tied with like 5 others for second lowest of the season. I don't consider that really indicative of the quality of this one, but what do you think, Jeremy?
Yeah, actually, that seemed pretty high for if that's one of the lowest episodes. I'm kind of, this one's a mixed bag for me. So that's actually a little higher than I would rate it, honestly.
Oh, okay. All right. So while the rating seems high, maybe its placement with the others doesn't feel quite as right for me.
Yeah, that's fair.
And, okay, the writer of the episode was Charles Holland, who also worked in a similar vein for New York Undercover and Profiler around that time. His most recent credits are for Black Lightning, The Quad, and JAG. And Wide Open was directed by James Charleston, who did 4 episodes of The X-Files, Avatar, Teleco, or Teleco, depending on how you pronounce that, Synchrony, and Elegy. And he brings some of those distinctive touches to Millennium, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that there's a lot that it has going for it. I just think, like, compared maybe to what the peak of Millennium can be, it's maybe not as good as the... That's more saying the quality of the show in general, more less of a dig, I think, at this episode.
The idea of a killer at an open house is a really eerie concept of the world that we live in, having these potential hazards that could affect each and every one of us. And so it fits right into the mold that Millennium established for season 1.
Yeah, I mean, this premise, I'm surprised you haven't seen, like, I'm a big horror movie buff, and I'm surprised you don't see this. There is a trope of, like, the killer is in the walls of the house or something like that, that you see often in modern horror, but I'm surprised this idea of a killer that sneaks in the house during an open house and just stays there, that's pretty terrifying.
Right. That's exactly, I was just going to do the setup. It was in Seattle, and a driver was pulling up to the open house, and he's quiet, but he's polite. He looks around the house. He fixates on a youngster's things, like the size chart of how tall she's grown and her dolls, and he just stays in the house until the open house is over. And the family arms the burglar alarm, but all is really not secure. And then we hear those terrifying screams from upstairs at the end of the teaser. So petrifying, right?
Yeah, that's scary. It's one of those things you think about. It was like, if you're in charge of an open house, does somebody go check all the closets? Or is that even something anybody would think about? Maybe after they watch this one, they would.
Exactly. I'm thinking the exact same thing. After this came out, that probably became standard. Check everything. So the episode opens with a quote from Job. His children are far from safety. They shall be crushed at the gate without a rescuer. Of course, on Millennium, we have a rescuer. So Frank Black is called in. He very quickly figures out this killing was premeditated and how the murderer did it. He finds the little girl closed in a vent in the wall. I think this is one of the better aspects of the episode in that it works Frank's wife Catherine in rather seamlessly, and their relationship is sort of at the crux of the series in season one, but it's not always handled this well.
Yeah, that was actually one of my notes too. And this episode comes right after The Well-Worn Lock, which I think in a lot of ways was Chris Carter kind of creating a template for how he maybe envisioned Catherine would be used. Mm-hmm. As almost like the follow-up for what Frank does is like you catch the killer, but then it's not really quite over with. And that's kind of what Catherine's role is. And then this episode, in a lot of ways, is one of the better examples of like what to do with Catherine in the season one mode.
Did you notice that both the Blacks sort of used the same words when they were trying to help this traumatized child? Like at the house, Frank says, everything's going to be all right. Nobody's going to hurt you. We're here to help you. And then at the hospital, Catherine says to her, you're in a safe place. No one's going to hurt you here.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. That's interesting.
They're on the same wavelength.
Yeah, and you kind of get that sense early on that like Frank on his end knows that it would make sense, like what Bletch wants is to question the girl. But then because he has a sense of like the other end of it, what Catherine does with the social work, he also has that side. So the tension is like, it's like he immediately knows what this built-in tension is going to be.
Right. And that's another great touch. He doesn't want to involve this child in the investigation and not inducing the witness to help in what they're trying to do and trying to catch this killer is really a unique alteration for the time. It's not something that this show or other shows really did.
Yeah, for sure.
So then as the episode progresses, they figure out the killer was at this family's first open house and he cased the joint at that one. That's how he figured out what he was going to do. And we really see him as a very smart guy in He's almost too smart about it. He wants them to know how smart he is.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think he's one of the stronger serial killers or criminals that the show has to offer, but it doesn't necessarily spend a lot of time with him. It's more about the fallout of it and the little girl and the trauma and all that stuff. But yeah, I definitely think he's good. He's a good enough killer. Maybe not one of the more memorable like characters, but like the gimmick of like what he does, I think is interesting enough or like memorable enough.
Well, Frank figures out he's a risk taker and he uses like the name he used to sign in the guest book is his neighbor's name. So he's playing these huge games in it. And they bring in actor Glenn Turman to be the handwriting expert to examine this book and tell us about this guy who says he's John Allworth. And Glenn Turman, I don't know if you recognized him, but he's been in everything from like The Wire to A Different World.
Yeah, he did stand out. I didn't recognize him. It's one of those character actors. I didn't really quite remember where I've seen him. The performance was memorable, though. I was just going to say, I think that I don't know if I buy the handwriting analysis. It was like my biggest complaint with this episode is some things feel a little too convenient, maybe, or maybe for the purpose of speeding up plot, we going to get, you know, a handwriting analysis that knows exactly who the killer is right away. And I don't know if that's quite how that works, but I guess for the purposes of the story, you kind of roll with it.
I think it kind of is very much like a traditional procedural. And he says he has rage, he has anger,
yeah.
He can be explosive. And that's something we've seen a lot of and isn't particularly different, but I think it's unique in they send Detective Gibblehouse, who is Stephen Lang, who's in his fourth episode of the show, goes to this address they have for John Allworth. And so the killer can watch them conducting the investigation. I think it's a little too on the nose for Gibblehouse to be peeking through the eye hole, because whoever saw anything through an eye hole,
you can't see through it.
But it's an incredible shot. The shot looks beautiful.
And it does remind me of Chris Carter early on had kind of said that Seven, the movie Seven, was kind of like his inspiration for the show. And even this killer in that apartment, that looks like something out of Seven. Just the old gritty layers and just creepy guy in his dark apartment, you know?
So back at the hospital, this little girl, Patricia, seems to be hiding a face in the picture she's drawing. And there's a nice scene with Catherine, and she brings her Jordan's little pink bow. And she tells her her daughter has curly hair, and this Patricia's hair is like long and straight. And Jordan wants curly hair, so she guesses that Patricia wants curly hair because that's how...
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Little girls are, you know, it was a sweet little scene.
Yeah, I think that works really well. And just kind of showing a more nurturing side of, I guess, like if the Black family is kind of meant to be this multifaceted way that we view the show, I think just even bringing in Jordan and showing this sort of family dynamic, this episode in particular has good stuff with Frank and Catherine and just their family in general, like where sometimes it will be a little forced, I think.
Okay, so first Frank and Gibblehouse go back to the house, and Gibblehouse is this real doubting Thomas, or at least a doubting Bob, and he wonders what they're going to find that an army of technicians didn't find, and it's like, have you met Frank Black? Do you know him? So he figures out that the killer took the VCR and he took these videotapes and he actually filmed the attack. That's how brazen this guy is. And then he sends it to the real estate agent who conducted the open house. And the tape is very, you know, graphic of the couple tied up and begging them to spare their lives, their daughter's life. And Frank assumes it's to punish her for whatever her imaginary crime is.
Yeah, which would make sense. I did notice a weird Easter egg when they cut right to the real estate place. There's a sign that says like killer prices, killer deals or something like that. It seemed like a really dark... I never noticed that, but it seemed like right from that, it was like kind of a dark joke in that episode, I think.
That is.
I never really noticed before. Yeah.
That is very dark.
Yeah.
Very, very dark. And then we get into this pattern where, okay, so first it was Gibblehouse, and then Lieutenant Bob Bletcher comes on, and he's with Frank, and he's saying kind of the same things Gibblehouse said, and they kind of go over this thing about using the girl a few times, and maybe one or two times too many.
Yeah, like I said, coming back to like just my main criticism is it's a little on the nose, like especially when we learn the motivations of the killer that seem to sync up pretty conveniently with like the theme of the episode, which is generally a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It just may be a little too on the nose for my taste.
Right, right. I had that later on in my notes. Same kind of thing. Yeah. So Bletcher is, of course, Bill Smitrovich. It's his sixth episode of the series. I know him best from the series Life Goes On. Did you know him before Millennium?
I think it's probably this that I remember him from. Again, he's like one of those character actors that you've seen in a lot of things. Like he was probably in, I think he might have been Independence Day when I was a kid. He's got a small role, but I don't remember him from Life Goes On.
Well, nowadays he's better known for being in Ted and Ted 2. So then we're back with this killer again. He's played by Pablo Coffey, who reminds me a lot of this Tony Award winning dynamo Jefferson Mays, who was recently in I Am the Night as the Doctor of Death. He's very similar to him, so he's very, very good at being bad. He's been on Supernatural, Stargate, and another series in the 1013 family, Harsh Realm.
Oh, nice.
So for what he's given, I think he's perfect. He's extremely creepy, and I'm scared to death of him. So he goes to his next house. He's upping the ante. He takes the tour, and he wants to know about the alarm system and how to use it, and that's what the realtor does. He just shows him this state-of-the-art motion detection system.
Yeah, I do like the scene right before that where they cut to the killer, and he's just basically rehearsing.
Yes.
Hello. Like, yeah, and then it cuts right. That's a nice kind of inversion where we hear the the realtor say that. But yeah, that was in particular a really creepy scene. Just like he's kind of going through the motions of pretending to be a person.
Right. Hi, how are you? That,
yeah.
He is also the one who calls, not because he's done the perfect crime. He's the one who has to call 911 to report this break-in. And unlike most serial killers, he's changed his whole methodology. This victim was divorced with no children at home. Did you like how the stakes sort of escalated rather than using the same MO again?
Yeah, I think it makes sense for it to be where only Frank really sees the through line. Wherever on the surface, everybody's kind of like, this is a different MO. It's not the same killer. But Frank is able to kind of see the thing that nobody else does. So I think that kind of helps reinforce his profiling abilities.
And speaking of him doing that, at the second crime scene, Frank finds the X under the welcome mat. And right about the same time when we're with Catherine and Patricia, we see her drawing also has an X on it. So let's talk a little bit about how this case kind of hits home for Frank. And it happens a lot in the first season. You know, he's got a wife and a daughter he loves. And it's got to be kind of terrible for him to be plunging into this abyss to stop this killer.
Yeah, even the idea of, like, Catherine bringing Jordan into the room with that girl. I mean, I don't even know if that's a proper behavior for a social worker, but maybe it is, you know. But it's, again, it's like they've kind of put their entire life into this in a way that it is personal. I think that's a good element of this episode, is that the family union is kind of also there to try to help solve whatever these crimes that he's investigating.
Right. So it's not exactly traditional or how they draw it up in the books, but it's working for them. And I guess it's working for the people they're helping.
Right.
But the real beauty, I think, of the episode is that they really never have to bring this child in and press her on what she saw. And it's Frank's detection. He finds the image of the killer in the reflection of the video. So that's their first and best lead.
Yeah, I think it does a pretty good job of building that tension, and that it seems obvious to have the girl questioned. And then it kind of, the built-in tension of that, and I think it does a pretty good job. Because the performance from the little girl, it's like, it's pretty good. Like, it's pretty, you have a sense that this girl's been kind of damaged by this, obviously.
Right.
But yeah, it kind of lands.
Yeah, we're definitely sympathetic to her.
Yeah.
At some point, Catherine is still against the idea of bringing her in, but once Frank has this image that he got from the videotape, she says, Frank, whatever is best for the investigation. And that's when he realizes that's what the killer wanted all along, for the police to have to use this child to catch him, for her to relive everything that happened to her.
Yeah, it works. I think we needed a little bit more from the killer. Like, we only get like a little bit of exposition at the end as far as like what happened to him. But
right.
Yeah, I think it all kind of syncs up pretty well, where it kind of validates Catherine's point of view. It's particularly Catherine's point of view that of not making this girl relive it. And then it syncs up really well when we learn that. But I think we could have learned a little bit more. It's maybe a little too convenient that it's the same thing. I don't know. Maybe that's just me kind of, you know.
No, it really is kind of tacked on there at the end to just wrap it up. This is why. Maybe it would be better if we didn't know what his rationale, kind of creepier if we didn't know.
Yeah, that might have worked a little bit better too. Hard to say.
So this guy is so cocksure that he leaves clues for them constantly. I'm not sure the video was part of his plan for someone to catch him in a reflection, but he does dump the shotgun in the garbage and he calls it in, and oh, he's a crossing guard with a big yellow X on his back. So there's the X.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was supposed to have been he left that for them, the gun, because I was like, hopefully he left it for him and didn't try to dispose of the evidence right where he works by accident.
Right.
But yeah, I think it was meant to be that he was kind of getting too cocky and upping the stakes.
Yeah, and Frank says he's teaching lessons about our pretensions to safety, about how vulnerable we are. So I think he did kind of leave it there on purpose. But
yeah,
in a lot of ways, if we didn't have Frank telling us this, it could be seen maybe it's this way, maybe it's this way.
I do think the bit of the Frank, the bit of Frank and Catherine, I don't know if we've got, have we got to that part yet where they have the scene together where they kind of talk about when he's outside about the idea of safety and the kind of the theme of the episode. I think that scene in particular kind of raises the, it would raise the quality of the episode just up a little bit for me, because I think that stuff really works.
Yes, that's, it's exactly where we are, and it's, this is the scene that I remembered most from the original airing, how they're talking about people never used to lock their doors day or night, and it, there's a little bit of preaching going on. We seem to have accepted it so gracefully, so naturally. We've allowed ourselves to become almost besieged by our own fear.
Oh, yeah. I would say I just like this, these kind of things. Yes, it's very preachy in a way. Or like Chris Carter had talked about the idea of Frank Black as sort of like a Western hero. And there is something sort of traditionally like an old American character about Frank. It sounds like an old man, you know, talking about the way things used to be, but there is an element to that that I find kind of compelling. Maybe the older I get, the more I find that more compelling.
I think it's sort of a hallmark of the series. It's what Chris Carter had in mind, and even if he didn't write this episode, maybe this is one of the little touches he added to it when he looked it over. Well,
hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Lucky Land Casino. Asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Oh, yeah.
This kind of means this.
This reeks of Chris Carter from this period, too. Like, this, I wouldn't be surprised if he wrote that at all.
So now they got to catch this guy, and all three of our people, Frank, Bletch, and Gibblehouse, they're all at the same house, even though other houses are being watched. They're at this Ivy Meadows designer safety homes place. And the killer is there. The killer, of course, coming to the place where these our three characters are. Asks the realtor if a family lives there, and she gives this really lame excuse about why a door is locked. But what really sets the killer off is he sees a guy who doesn't look anything like a prospective buyer in the hallway. So he goes upstairs and out the window. But the key is that Frank knows he's not really gone. So he gets all the police to leave, and just he and Bletch stick around. And then our hero, a dog outside, whimpering outside a front door, and that tips Frank off. And this is where the episode falls apart a bit for me. I'm not sure why Bletch had food for the dog, but it turns out to be a good thing. And Frank gets in the house, and the gagged couple are trying to warn him that the killer's in the closet, but he doesn't catch on. The guy who is so intuitive about everything does not catch on that the killer is right behind him and gets conked. So good thing this dog was on duty and attacks the man who attacked his family. I am all in favor of the dog being the hero.
Yeah, it's a little cheesy. And again, it's like the little too convenient, but there's a part of me that's a sucker for like plots that kind of come together where early on the Rottweiler, Gibblehouse makes an offhand comment that they should have just saved the $5,000 on the high tech security and just gotten a Rottweiler.
Yes.
And then the Rottweiler. And it kind of goes into this sort of like preachy, the way things used to be kind of nostalgia that the episode I think might have a little bit of, but I don't know. It worked all right.
No, like, you can spend all this money on the highest tech security system, and when it comes down to it, the dog is going to be the one that saves you, not your high-tech security system. So what did you think about Frank and Bletch are sort of bantering about as slow a rate as possible about one of them calling the paramedics for this killer, and they're in no hurry.
That's pretty dark. I mean, it's not particularly heroic. I get it. Like, no, but they deal with this all the time. They should, you just can't let this guy die. That's not really their job. That's one of their jobs. It's not just, is to take care of their suspects and criminals.
They're dark, but they're not that dark.
Yeah.
So, like you previously mentioned, it's a little clunky when they reveal this killer's motives. I mean, it's basically one or two throwaway lines. His parents had sent him off to his aunt and uncle, and he saw them tortured by a farmhand. And then tragedy begets itself until the circle is broken. And that really made me wonder about this girl. What's going to happen to this girl? I mean, she's at this turning point. So is Catherine and Jordan, are they her saviors? Or is the potential for this to be happening? I guess it would be now, because it's this many years later since that episode aired. But did that creep you out at all?
See, I kind of took it as we're meant to just assume that the circle is broken now because she was never forced to relive it. And again, it's just like, it's a little too simplistic, I think, for the issues. That's how I took it. But it does end on a very strange note. Like, it's very somber, even though it's supposed to be a kind of a victory. So I kind of like to me, it didn't have a creepiness. It was just kind of more like, this is the closest thing to a victory that they could achieve in this situation. And it's still not really a victory.
Well, I think it makes a good point for Millennium. And you know, we can watch episodes for 45 minutes. But the reality is, when these things happen, that, you know, that little girl's life is changed for good, no matter what Catherine or Jordan or the best foster home parents in the world can do for her. Like you said, I think the circle is broken, but she's also a little broken too. And that's why it seems so sad at the end. But it's really a beautiful scene where they're holding hands, Patricia and Jordan, and Bletch takes each girl by a hand and he compliments the teddy bear.
Yeah.
I don't know why I love that little bit so much, but maybe it's because we don't usually see that kind of thing. He says that, you know, she has a nice teddy bear.
Yeah, you get a sense that Bletch is a real person sometimes, too. I think that's instead of just being a foil for the plot, you know, like through a lot of the episode, Bletch kind of feels like he's there to just create tension for the story, you know, and then little things like that. You're like, oh, this is a real person, too. I like that.
Right. Because somebody has to say something against Frank. You know, there has to be some kind of butting of heads, even though it got repetitive with the let's use the girl. That humanizes him greatly, I think. And we end with a sort of a really quick look at Frank and Catherine, and they're just embracing. But overall, like I said, I think this was definitely one of the better episodes at this point in the season for their dynamic.
Yeah, I agree. Like, there's even like little, like the show kind of got criticism that I think is kind of fair, that their relationship is a little almost platonic. You know, it doesn't seem like this is a husband and wife sometimes. And there's like little part where like the scene we were talking about earlier where they're outside and there's a little bit of flirtation and it feels like that seems like they're a real couple, you know, rather than almost partners. It's almost similar to like the Mulder and Scully X-Files dynamic where the sexual part is not really there or comes into play very rarely. So I think, yeah, you get a real sense of that they're partners, that they're husband and wife, but they're also like in a sense like partners in what they do as far as like these kind of crimes are involved, and they complement each other in an interesting way. So I definitely think it's one of the stronger Catherine episodes.
Definitely. I definitely agree with that. Okay. You said there were some good points and some bad points in this episode. Was there anything we didn't cover that was kind of a sticking point for you about Wide Open?
I think we kind of hit on it. There wasn't anything in particular. It was just more the sense of a little too convenient, and that's probably just the sense of procedural TV at the time. So, like, Millennium in particular, season one, I think would have some of those issues. They're maybe not problems, they're just maybe they don't age as well or something. I'm not quite sure. There's nothing really big. It's just a little too convenient at times.
Right. Now, I have one little sticking point that really bothered me. The little girl's name is Patricia Highsmith. I find that incredibly distracting. Maybe like Trisha Highsmith would have been enough, because the real Patricia Highsmith is a renowned suspense novelist who wrote Strangers on a Train and The Talented Mr. Ripley and a lot of other things. And so whenever the name was, you know, when it was just Patricia, it was okay. But when you say Patricia Highsmith, it really takes me out of it greatly. So I was sort of annoyed by that.
Yeah, that's a little too on the nose.
Okay, so we had 6 episodes between Dead Letters and Here. What kind of progression have you seen with the show?
Well, the show got a lot of criticism for being the serial killer of the week, but I think even if you look at like the first handful of episodes, there's an attempt to try to deviate from that. Or how do we tell? Like, I was criticizing it for having procedural elements, but it never really feels like it's going through the motions that in such a boring way. Like, it, even by episode 6, they're trying to figure out how to tell these stories, how to involve Catherine, how to tell them from different points of view. So, I mean, there is a really good variety of, even when it's trying to do stories in a certain tone or style. So I think you do see a good deal of inventiveness.
I totally agree with that. It kind of makes you wonder how they would have been able to sustain this if they didn't have such a wild swing in season 2, and then they have another one for season 3. I don't see how they would have been able. They came up with a great concept here. Maybe there are more concepts like this that they could have found, but it really makes me wonder, looking at this one now and back where we were. And Dead Letters was another concept that I really appreciated. It was different, and they put the Millennium spin on it. But how could they have sustained that?
Yeah, it's interesting to think about. Like, this episode, like I was saying, I sometimes feel like there's a Chris Carter episode that's like a template, that it's viewed as a template for other writers, where, like, this episode might have been like, this is a Catherine, like, Well-Worn Lock would have been a Catherine template. Like, this is what you can do with that character. And then people started, you see, like, not necessarily copying it, but maybe not. It's variations on an idea. And then, yeah, if it would have been able to go, by the time you get to the end of the first season, you get all kinds of variety of storytelling. So that's still, I think, still in the same vein of season 1. So, yeah, it's really hard to say how long it could have gone.
Okay, let's dip into the Millennium Mailbag and see what we have here. Kurt North said, I like that they tried to involve Catherine a bit more in this one. Other than Well-Worn Lock, she has had little to do but worry. The idea that someone can hide and do what they need to do is a fear of ours at work, too. We have a huge building, so pretty much anyone could hide out somewhere until after we close. It's a primal fear that's someone lurking to pounce. And that's really it. I mean, it doesn't have to, you don't have to be selling your house to get the fear associated with this episode.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a terrifying concept.
Just the idea of someone popping out of the shadows. I think you mentioned scary movies earlier, and maybe that's why they're so popular. We're trying to, like, undercut that fear by being able to laugh at it or scream at it or something like that. Okay, Michael Little said, I like this episode more than most. The concept of a killer hiding in houses is very creepy. While I know some hate the ending with the dog, I always thought that was the perfect justice. I wonder if it's all dog people who say.
Well, you know, the dog gets to be the hero. Normally in a kind of thriller or horror, the dog is, you know, like the first one to go. So I always find that bit of a cheap shot. So maybe victory for the dog is a good thing.
That's true. Even in Jaws, the dog is one of the first ones to go. And no one ever cries or puts a bounty on the shark's head for the dog. Poor Pippet. Anyway, sorry. I digress. Adam Silva said, for some reason, I can never remember this one. And it's kind of the opposite for me, because many of the other procedurals from season 1 ran together. This one seems more indelible to me between the concept and how they worked Catherine in.
Yeah, I wonder if the sort of serial killer of the week format would kind of breed, not necessarily a sameness, but it might be hard to remember them after a while. If it's week after week of a different killer, you know,
mm-hmm.
I remember this one pretty well, but I do think of it in my mind as maybe not as one of the more memorable ones, if that makes sense.
Were you watching? I forget. Were you watching this during original run, or did you come to Millennium later?
No, I would have been watching it in its original run, and I would have been pretty young, like 14, 15, something like that.
And, you know, back in the day when we were watching like that, like once a week, I don't think it would have hit home as much that we were seeing the same kind of episode.
Right.
Because, like, when you're binging, you're like, oh, God, another procedural episode. But when you see one a week and there are substantial differences to them, it's not as jarring.
Yeah, it's like, again, with anything, you kind of have to, like, think of the context, you know? So when I'm criticizing it for having procedural elements, it also was a show that was doing way more, like, stylized things visually, more interesting, like, you know, Chris Carter purple prose, like, things that you weren't seeing on TV, too. So it's like, I'm criticizing it now a little bit for some of the procedural elements, but, you know, at the time that was also the nature of almost all TV. And it was, and the show also did so many other things that were groundbreaking that it's, you know,
I know,
not a huge criticism.
Right, because when I think of procedurals of the time, there was nothing like this. Even something like Profiler didn't have the resonance that this has. And I think in the first season, it's because these things that happen seem to be more real to me. Like, I can understand them. You know, when you're watching a procedural about something that happens that you aren't even close to, you don't really get that kind of emotional reaction to it.
Well, yeah, and the show, one of its biggest criticisms, like when it originally aired, was that it was too dark. And it's like, well, it's just, it's actually just playing the material properly how I would look at it. Like, these are all really dark things. Like, I understand that it could be hard to watch, and it probably was one of the reasons that the show, like, wasn't as popular as, say, like X-Files, is it's not necessarily the most fun thing to watch sometimes. You have to be kind of in the mood for it. But at the same time, it doesn't feel as, like, airless or you're more affected by what you're watching based on the subject matter. So I feel like it's appropriately dark.
But the funny thing is to think of it now, you know, nowadays, this isn't dark at all. The things we see, you know, if you're watching Hannibal or something, that is dark. Maybe in a few years, that won't be so dark because someone else will have invented something else that seems even darker. So right now, this seems kind of light. not light, but.
No, absolutely. I remember watching Hannibal. I couldn't believe they got away with that on network TV. But like back when Millennium first came out, it was the same feeling. So,
I think that the press has a lot to do with the way people view it too, because we're talking about Hannibal and people loved that, but the press loved it.
Right.
So the press kept saying good things. Now when Millennium was out, oh, dark, 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 you know.
Right.
But I guess they were comparing it to the level of The X-Files, which was this great success.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I think there's a clear, I mean, and other people have pointed this out, I think there's a clear line between Millennium and, say, Hannibal. Like, even the producers of that show would point that out. I mean, you have Lance Henriksen in Hannibal and Gillian Anderson and stuff like that. But yeah, you can definitely see a progression from, I think, Millennium pushing the boundaries of what kind of stories you could tell and what you could get away with visually on network TV. It's definitely underrated in that way. People say underrated a lot, but this is a show not a lot of people are familiar with, but I think had a huge impact in pushing things forward.
Definitely, definitely. I was just thinking about Lance's performance in this, and he doesn't really get to show enough of how affected he is, how close this scenario of the killings is to what his own family life is. And I might have wanted a little bit more of that in this episode.
Yeah, that's fair. I do like, there's a little bit early on when he rescues the girl from the vent. I like that scene a lot. It gets to show. I like when you see him as not necessarily a traditionally masculine role, like in the way that he's just very sympathetic and caring towards other people too as well. And it's makes him a little bit more of a complex figure, I think.
Yes, I think that's why he's my favorite character, and not just on Millennium. He's one of my favorite characters of all time. He can go in so many different directions, and, you know, obviously Chris Carter wrote it for him, so he's perfect for this sort of mold. But he can do anything, he could be anything, which is why I think the 3 seasons of Millennium are great, because he can do this, or he can go this way, or he can go this way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But he didn't really get to give much of that to this particular episode. But other than your scene that you mentioned is right at the vent. I mean, he's so wonderful with the little girl. And the scene with Catherine is wonderful, but there's no other taste of that beyond that.
Yeah, no, yeah, I agree. I think a lot of it, I wonder if you could chalk a lot of this, the problems up to this with just time constraints. Like there's only so much you can do in, you know, 44 minutes or whatever.
Right. And they're sort of saving things for some of the episodes coming up. You can't use them all in every single episode. Okay. Is there anything else you wanted to bring up in regards to Wide Open?
No, I think that about covers it for me.
All right. I think we did an excellent job. So, Jeremy, remind us where we can find you on the World Wide Web.
You can find me in various social media platforms at Jeremy D. Daniels. I have a website. It's jeremydanielscomics.com. I'm self-publishing comics and graphic novels and stuff. Some of the art for this podcast, that'll be my art, too.
Oh, that is awesome. Because you are excellent. You're excellent. I can often be found at sibling_cinema on Twitter, and we're also on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest, and also in the newly renamed The Yellow House, a Millennium Podcast fan group on Facebook. So thank you, Jeremy.
Yeah, thanks.
And thanks for listening, and remember, this is who we are.
The Time Is Now, a Millennium Podcast, was created by Tony Black, who co-produces alongside Kurt North. You can find the show on Twitter at The Time Is Now Pod, and on Facebook if you type in The Time Is Now, plus we have a Facebook fan group called The Yellow House, full of active Millennium discussion. The Time Is Now is also part of the We Made This Podcast Network at We Made This Pod, alongside a range of popular culture shows about TV, film, music and beyond, including our sister show The X-Cast and X-Files podcast. For advance access to The Time Is Now and access to bonus material, consider supporting the X-Cast and We Made This on Patreon at patreon.com/TheX-Cast. That's PATREON/TheX-Cast. You'll find a full range of subscription tiers available. Thanks for listening.